Well, I think that if there's any compliment that I can pay a writer such as yourself, is that in reading Stars and Bars, I found myself suddenly bursting into laughter. This is something very unusual, because usually you'll read a book, and even if it's simply funny, you kind of nod mentally. But I found myself breaking into laughter for a number of places that I thought particularly funny. The portion where your hero, whose name is Henderson Doors, is at the restaurant, and the waiter comes up and says, "Hello, my name is James, I'm your waiter." Doors gets up, and I thought that was hilarious. Yes. And even at the end, I also like the part where he throws his wallet
with
the people he bought for the muggers. And at the end, where he is asking the young woman in the loft building to call the police because he's been kidnapped, and she slaps him, and one of the kidnappers says, "Oh, the ladies, man." There was a wonderful story, and it was a Neil Simon story. It kind of brings to mind the incident about the wallet. It was a... it was made into a movie. I can't remember the name of the movie, but you might remember the tale. The movie had Jack Lemmon in it.
Oh, is it the Out of Towners or something like that? Or the
Sandy
Dennis, I think, in Jack Lemmon, something like that.
Well, at any rate, Jack Lemmon was in Central Park, and he is bumped by a jogger, and Jack Lemmon feels for his wallet, and it's gone. And he realizes that he's just been bumped, and he knows he took the wallet, so he runs after this jogger, slams you up against the tree, and he says, "All right, hand it over. Give it to me. Give me that wallet." The guy gives him the wallet, you know. If he takes it home and he opens the wallet, it's not his. there is this feeling in New York City of paranoia. those were really...
I'm glad. I'm really pleased.
Wonderful episodes. I want to ask you some things about the book. I want to ask you some things about yourself before we start, because I've never met anybody who, outside of a taxi driver here and there, who was born in Guyana.
Yes. I'm typical kind of colonial offspring in a way. My father was a doctor, and he practiced medicine in tropical Africa because he specialized in it. And I was born there, and in West Africa in particular, there's a lot of people out there just for a career, whereas in East Africa you have second or third generation white East Africans, as it were. But it's quite common in you know, the far-flung colonies produced a great kind of class of functionaries. And when I was at school, for example, I would say maybe 10 or 15% of the other children there lived abroad in India or Singapore or Hong Kong, lots of them from Africa. And when we went home on holiday by plane, entire planes would be filled with kids returning to their parents. It's just, you know, it's a great sort of source of work for your average middle-class Brit. Well, was, not so much now. It's much more the odd technological thing. But certainly in the pre- and post-Second World War years, lots and lots of British people made their working lives out in Africa.
Does your family still live in Africa?
No, they left in the mid-70s. My father became ill, and but he spent 30 years out there. You know, virtually his entire working life was spent in either Ghana or Nigeria.
But you you said you went away to school, so you probably left at a fairly early age.
Yeah, I was there until I was 9. Then I was sent to a boarding school, and
where did you go?
To a boarding school, to a school called Gordonston.
And that was where, in England?
In Scotland, north of Scotland. But I always returned to Africa for the holidays. Well, not every holiday, but 2 out of 3. So until about the age of 19 or 20, when I went to university, I always thought of my, as one does, I thought of my home as where your parents live, and that was in Africa. So it's...
You have never lived there since that time?
No, I haven't been back since, I think, 1973 was the last time.
So you have made what your home now?
Well, now I live in London, but I was at university in Scotland for 4 years, and then I was in Oxford for 7 years. And I was doing a PhD there and ended up teaching at Oxford. Mm. And I left there 2 years ago and moved to London.
What did you study?
English literature, but I was doing a PhD on Shelley, and the sort of intellectual background to the Romantic period in the early 19th century, poetry, Wordsworth, Coleridge, that kind of thing.
What did you teach at Oxford?
I was lowly academic there. I taught a lot of 20th century stuff because none of the dons wanted to teach that. And I also did that, a lot of romanticism, the romantic poets, and taught classes in the 19th century novel, all sorts. Anything that the fellows didn't want to do, they handed on to me.
Because I love the contemporary novel. When I mean contemporary, I mean material that is currently being written by writers who may or may not survive the years. And this is an idea that outrages some academics. The famous American literary critic Alfred Kazin, for example,
yeah.
Teaches at the Graduate School of English at the City University of New York. And his students are giving him a thesis on John Irving,
yeah.
And writers like that. And many of these writers, or Saul Bellow,
yeah.
Many of these writers may last indefinitely, we don't know. But his belief is that, and this goes back to what you were saying about the dons there,
yeah.
Hoisting the 20th century stuff,
yes.
Onto you, he thinks that literature, in order to be best comprehended and understood and appreciated, is that which has lasted over the years. So he is an aficionado of 19th century
yeah,
literature.
Yeah. I think it's you should teach the literature of your own time. I mean Oxford was very, very hidebound. I mean, until recently, you know, English literature stopped in 1914, as far as they moved up to 1945, and I think now it's crept up to 1960. So if you want to study somebody like Sylvia Plath, for example, who, though she's American, is very much bound up in the British poetic tradition, you can't study her at Oxford because the syllabus stops at 1960. I think that's crazy because I think people, you know, studying literature often have the most direct route is to the literature produced in their own century, certainly, if not their own decade or their own lifetime. But I am against that kind of the PhD factory sort of thing, and that people get enshrined in a kind of academic reputation which has no relation to what their you know, popular success or critical success is. It's certain writers, you know, can just go direct into the academy. And
one of our major prestigious awards is the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
And the award was given to Alison Lurie last week for fiction. Very, very fine writer.
Yes,
as a matter of
yes.
fact, her novel, Foreign Affairs, is set in London.
That's right.
Very fine novel. But it's interesting that if you look in one of the almanacs at the various winners of the Pulitzer Prizes for literature over the years, it's incredible the number of people that I've never heard of.
Yes.
I mean, they've gotten their award and they packed it in
yes.
and they vanished.
Yes. I don't know if that's a phenomenon that's particularly American, in that the universities here can subsidize a writer or tend to subsidize a writing career much more than in England. Because often it seems to me that a lot of American their output is much smaller. You know, partly because maybe they're doing so, you know, financially well enough not to have to write another book. And I don't know if something like I met William Kennedy in London. He's just one of these I don't know what they call genius awards.
Yeah, the MacArthur
Award.
You know, 200, I think it's $250,000.
You know, and he
4 years
at this lunch where you know all the it was at what they call a punch lunch. Punch magazine have a lunch, and he was a sort of guest of honor. And when he was talking about this, you could see all the hacks and the other writers at the table, jaws dropping and sort of it's going green with envy. But you just can't get that kind of patronage.
That's rare. I mean, how many people get that? And William Kennedy is a man who put in his dues.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, if anybody deserved it. Didn't Raymond Carver get
Raymond Carver won a similar award. I believe that was the Strauss Award.
Yes.
It was very, very similar.
Well, he's another man who deserves a...
Carver overcame a lot of his own problems with alcoholism to come back and win that. Kennedy, of course, worked for years and years,
yes.
could not sell his work,
yes.
and his work was consistently rejected up until just a couple of years ago.
Yes, he's had a huge kind of been rediscovered, hasn't he, in his own lifetime.
He's okay, he's doing fine now, but this is very rare. I mean, most writers indeed supplement their incomes with other work, college work primarily, or just anything they can do, because it's very difficult to make a living writing.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm wrong.
Are you writing full time now?
Yes, I am. I've been doing that for about 2 years.
Mm.
And I'm extremely conscious of how lucky and how precarious the existence.
Do you have a public? Do you have a benefactor?
No, I don't.
Just in case.
No, I don't. I think I'm fortunate in that I sell well in paperback. And what I have done, and what has subsidized my novel writing, is that I've written two television films. So my screenplay writing has allowed me, you know, not to write a novel a year, so to speak.
Well, the paperback sales are vital, aren't they? I think you need the hardcover books for the reviews, so people will be able to be aware of them. Will call attention to the book, and the paperbacks, that's what people buy.
Yes, you're right. And if you don't write a novel a year, you sort of need your paperback to keep you floating until the next novel comes out. But it's important to have an American publisher, and I'm also translated into other languages. So there is sort of revenue coming in from France and Finland and Holland and places like that. Unusual, but all these things. So you really need to kind of, have all tentacles out in all directions, and that way.
The American market is important for many British writers, isn't it?
It is, I think, particularly with the powerful dollar now. It's but usually because after your hardback advance from your British publisher, your American hardback advance is often, well, not often, but sometimes is the same. So really, the one book gets two reasonable advances, and with that you can kind of get through the year, and hope your paperback royalties and so on will bolster that kind of thing. But there are not many. I suppose it's exactly the same here. Not many people earning a living from writing full time. You usually have to do something else, either journalism or teaching or.
Journalism is a kiss of death to a writer.
Quite a lot of writers. Youngish writers of my age have a sort of secondary journalistic careers. A lot of poets as well do. I think of someone like Julian Barnes, whose books come out here.
Flaubert's Parrot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he's the television critic of The Observer and writes a weekly column. He's been doing that for some years. And Martin Amis is a special writer on The Observer as well. And writes
He was just here last week.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
You know his stuff?
Yes, I know him. I know him, and I know his books very well indeed, yes.
Another young English writer I talked to last week is Graham Swift.
Oh, yeah, I know him.
Have you read his stuff?
Yes, I have. In fact, Susan, my wife, works for his publishers. She's his publicity director, so she knows Graham really well.
Well, he's quite a bit different from you. And matter of fact, Graham Swift is more reminiscent of Raymond Carver.
Yeah.
Than many of the English writers I read.
He is, I think. He had a slow beginning to his career. His first two novels did nothing. And then with his third novel, Waterland, he had a huge success, and I think he got a very good American sale over here. And
that was his first, the first novel published in America.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And
now all of his stuff coming back in paperback.
Yeah.
I mean, all at once.
Yes, he's kind of been there, kind of going back and saying.
Yeah, he has a book of short stories out now, title of which escapes me.
It's Learning to Swim.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. In fact, the title story in that collection is the one that reminded me very much of Carver's stuff. And then, of course, I guess Waterland.
Waterland
has been out, but it's been reissued in paperback and two other books.
One's called the
Shuttercock.
And the sweet shop owner, is it?
Something like that. But that one hasn't come out yet.
Yes, that was his first novel.
Yeah, it should be out in May.
Yeah.
Well, enough about him. Let's talk about you and Stars and Bars. You've spent a certain amount of time in the United States, haven't you?
It probably doesn't add up to a lot of time. This is my fourth visit in, I suppose, 3 years, 4 years. So, roughly once a year. And... Because I grew up in West Africa, I grew up actually at that school with a lot of American kids because there were Peace Corps people and USAID people. And on the university campus where I lived, there were... So the curious kind of you know, polyglot society. And so I've had a kind of acquaintanceship with America before I ever got here.
Did you yourself take a grand tour of the South?
Well, it wasn't such a grand tour. We went down for about 2 weeks, and I knew what
to
I was
Atlanta.
Looking for. To Atlanta and South Carolina and Georgia, and then finished up in New Orleans for a few days. But I was going to accumulate impressions, really, and also went looking for a small town to sort of, or various small towns to create Luxora Beach. And so we just drove around and went off the beaten track and, you know, took it very leisurely and stopped where we felt like it.
You did find a prototype for Luxora
Yes,
Beach.
I did. It's a town on the Georgia-Alabama border called Tallapoosa, which I'd always wanted to go to because Wallace Stevens wrote a poem called Stars at Tallapoosa, which I was going to use as an epigraph of the book, actually. I mean, and we were just driving around there, and I saw it on the map. I've read, you know the poem, known it for years and years, and so I said, let's go to Tallapoosa. And it was, you know, whether it's wishful thinking or not, I don't know, but it was seemed just right. You know, it was slightly odd. It was midday, and it was deserted, and the bar in the book is just like the bar in Tallapoosa, full of men, quite drunk, and very old, and you know, there was a curious sort of atmosphere about the place, and
it
had this
real very uncomfortable walking into a place.
Yes, I think Susan was the first woman who'd ever walked into it. But it was great fun. It was, you know, that was a real bonus when you're researching a novel like that. And it was kind of holiday and just making notes and taking photographs and things. And
how did Luxora Beach get its name anyway?
Well, I mean, I love these names of these small American towns. And what I did was I got my Rand McNally Road Atlas, and I just went through all these, you know, all the index, and took out names. And, you know, I knew I wanted a sort of two-name town. And there were lots of beach, such and such beach. And
I meant that facetiously, because it's a running gag
through the book
about how it got its name, since it was not on a beach.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, That was deliberate, you know. I thought, what would be a weird name, you know, town in the middle of the country, call it beach, or so. It was just something I cobbled together out of an index of an atlas.
Your hero, if I can call him that, Henderson Doors, strikes me as the kind of man who would find it difficult to get along in virtually any environment, whether it's Ghana or England, kind of a gullible, impressionable person who takes people at face value and who always brings trouble on himself. Would you agree with that characterization?
He could get on perfectly well in English society, in the certain society he would live in, that he's escaping from, because he understands how it works. He understands the codes with which people speak and interact.
But he has to ride the underground occasionally.
Yes, sure. Yes, exactly.
And that's when he's going to run into trouble.
Yeah, but I mean, this is you see Henderson Doors on the London Underground all the time. I mean, there's something about British life that can accommodate that kind of inept person, you know, shy person, without too much difficulty. But you're right. Put him down anywhere else in the world, and he'd run into trouble. But I think segments of English society are designed to cope with precisely that sort of thing. If he was at a university, for example, he'd be completely at home. But and also working in the art world that he does, or if he worked in the City of London or somewhere like that, full of people like that, because that's an essential trait of the English personality, I think.
Turns out that his father wasn't much different than Henderson.
That's right. That's a cruel bit of irony that I wanted to stick in, you know.
You have created some stereotypical Southern people. Are you afraid that you might have done a disservice to the great personages of the South of America?
I don't know. It's always a problem when you're writing comedy to avoid verging on the stereotypical, because dealing with exaggeration, you're dealing with grotesques and so on. But I went down south to sort of check it out, and I, like most cliches, you know, they exist because there's a sound basis in fact for them existing. I think that they're primarily comic characters, and I could possibly have set the book elsewhere, and you would have had, in a different country, say France, and you might have you could have encountered a bizarre French count in a ramshackle chateau, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm not too worried about giving offence, because I think it's inevitable with the kind of comedy I write. But then I dish it out to everybody, so I'm not being partisan in any kind of way.
You are yourself are not like Henderson Doors, are you?
Well, I think I at first found my reaction to coming here to New York rather similar, because my education and background is rather like his, in that I spent nine and a half years of my life in a boarding school, a private school, and that experience conditions the mental attitudes of so many educated British people, and it's such a kind of thorough training that when you leave school you have to kind of unlearn it. And under moments of stress or under moments of unfamiliarity, I discovered that I would sort of fall back on these kind of safety devices which my education had provided me with, which in other words is to be very reserved, very kind of unemotional, and very really quite tense about things, because that's a kind of safety device. But that initial reaction stuck with me, and it was a comic idea that I wanted. I mean, it can be very funny as well, and it was a comic idea that I wanted to explore and develop. But apart from that, I would say that the points of similarity between me and the character are very vague ones, and probably exactly the same exists between, you know, most authors and their central characters.
You are a well-traveled young man, going to boarding school, flying back and forth to Africa, and growing up in Scotland, and certainly New York would not intimidate someone like yourself.
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think it's very good for British people to come here, because I think that this business of reserve is the key word I would use. And if I was going to contrast it to New York or America, the word I would use is a kind of candor and openness. And when those two things meet up, they don't blend or interact. I think there is a real gulf there. And I think that many British people have exactly the same kind of experience when they not just America, if they go to Australia, say, or if they go somewhere where there's a different set of codes and values, because Britain, so much of British life is conducted in code, and you say one thing meaning something else entirely differently, and everybody understands you. As soon as you're in a society where those codes aren't interpreted properly, everything, communication breaks down. It seems to me that the attractive thing about American life, from my point of view anyway, having come out of a society where these codes are practiced all the time, is that people are very forthright and direct. And I would say that Henderson's experience is typical of a large number of British people's experience, and that's certainly the reaction I got from the book when it's published in England. People could recognise that, and a lot of Americans who read it in England said exactly the same thing. So I don't think it's a unique experience. I think it's a very common one.
And yet New York is not like the rest of the country to any degree.
No, exactly.
I came here 18 years ago, but I was born in the Midwest of this country, educated in Ohio, and lived in small towns, Baltimore. But I came here, and it was a different world. When I crossed the river and I came into Manhattan, I wondered if the currency was going to be the same.
Yes, yes.
Certainly the language was different, the accents were different. I stopped to ask people for directions on the street, and that took three people before I found one who spoke English that I could understand. The customs were different, the prices were different, the cost of services and anything was different than it was on the other side of the river. And so I was extremely intimidated coming here, and people seemed abrupt, and it seemed as though yeah. I had come to a different world.
I mean, you're absolutely right, and I think that I can completely understand how that would happen. But it seems to me, and this is an outsider's view, that there is a level of common discourse from what I've experienced of American Americans, which is different from the level of common discourse that exists in Britain. And what's intriguing is that we're both speaking the same language, but we both have entirely different ways of communicating within it. And what's funny is when those two areas of discourse clash. And I think it's for a lot of English people, it can seem tremendously attractive, the kind of, you know, the forthrightness and directness of discourse that you get here, whatever the local differences and whatever the...
The English can be very forthright. I remember walking into a pub in London, and I sidled up to the bar, and I told the bartender, I said, I'd like to have a martini, please, straight up, very dry with a twist, just like I get it back in New York.
Yes.
And he said, this ain't no cocktail bar, mate. And he was very angry. He stepped back.
Yeah.
And maybe he felt I was intimidating him, but I didn't know that you couldn't go to a pub and just...
Yes.
You had to go to a cocktail lounge.
Yes, I mean, you know, we're talking in generalizations, and you'll always find exceptions to the points I'm making. You can go to London or go anywhere or go to Scotland and find, you know, very, very kind of forthright, candid people. But I think that there's something. I don't know what the reason is. My own feeling is it's to do with our terrible class system, which we're still suffering under. And I also feel it's to do with the way the middle classes in particular are educated in Britain, that produces a set of attitudes which, to a degree, condition the national stereotype. If we go back to stereotypes, the idea of how English people behave. And I was born in Africa, and I'm not English, I'm Scottish, so I sort of feel I look on Britain with something of an outsider's eye anyway. I don't feel... I'm certainly not English, but I feel at home anywhere in Britain. But I look at my fellow Brits, and I see the similar kind of traits that I can discern in, say, French people, another equally fascinating group of people. It's a kind of parlour game, in a way, picking out national characteristics, but some of them can be extremely alluring. And I feel that there is something about the American stereotype, if you like, which is very alluring to certain British people, whereas I wouldn't say there's much about the French national stereotype that's alluring at all.
No, not at all. Did you have a chance to read Paul Theroux's Kingdom by the Sea?
Yes, I read it. I mean, I've read lots of it. It was serialized. I haven't read it right the way through.
There was a lot of fallout from that book, and Theroux was telling me that he lives in London. His wife is English. He has a house there. And he was coming back through Heathrow, and he was going through customs, and the customs agent said, you're Theroux, the writer? Theroux said, yes. He said, well, I read your book, The Kingdom by the Sea. He said, if you don't like us, why are you living here?
Yes, yes.
Why don't you go to a more pleasant place? But Theroux does like the English, and he loves London, but he was very critical, wasn't he?
He was, and I think he spoke a lot of sense, but I think what got people angry about it was that in large attitudes he was right, but when he went to a particular place, like, for example, Durham in the north of England, his two nights in Durham and his impressions of Durham and how he fixed them seemed to people who knew Durham to be, you know, as if he was talking about somewhere else. And I think that that's a fair criticism, that it was his criticisms were delivered with such kind of magisterial cynicism that people then started saying, well, what is he right? Is he accurate? And then they look more closely at what he'd said.
Well, he said he was turning the mirror around on the English. He feels that you mentioned the class system, and he feels that was wrong. He said that the English seem to be hypercritical of other people.
Yes.
And call people in just everyday conversation, things like nigger, and Jew boy.
Yes.
And these are things that in America, it's not done.
Yeah.
You just don't do it.
I think
in
he's
mixed, a, in a mixed audience. It's just not done.
Yeah.
And yet, apparently, it's done there. I say it. I've been to it a couple of times, and I've never noticed anything like that.
I think that, you know, Theroux was right, and in his large criticism, but he provided his critics with ammunition because he wasn't right in specifics. But I must say, I thought a lot of his observations were entirely accurate and very entertaining. And another American writer I read in preparing Stars and Bars was Edmund Wilson, who, of course, hated the English with a passion. And in his book, The 40s, in that collection of sort of journals and memorabilia and so on, there are wonderful analyses of just what is wrong with the English. And to me, he seems absolutely right. And I put some of them in the mouth of one of my characters when she criticizes Henderson. And, that, you know, if an Englishman or a British person is honest, then they have to agree that there are a lot of insufferable attitudes which they have, which seem nowadays to be completely unjustified.
Well, William Boyd, we could go on talking for the rest of the afternoon, I have a feeling. There was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which I thought was hilarious, and that was the fencing teacher, who turns out to be a black. Now, there is no such thing in existence.
Well, you know...
Is there?
I don't know. I chose the sport because I thought I want a different sport, and I thought, well, what would be the most interesting guy to teach an Englishman fencing in New York? And so I made Eugene Teagarden black. I don't know. Maybe there is a fencing teacher, but it's a lot of that is my own kind of invention, but one hopes it has a certain ring of authenticity.
Do you know what the state sport is in Maryland, the state of Maryland?
No, what?
Jousting.
Oh, God. Well, there you are, you see. life beats fiction again. You know.
William Boyd, Stars and Bars, a very funny novel, and I thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. I hope you enjoy your stay in New York. And are you working on something new now, I trust?
Yes, I have.
You better be.
Yes, I am.
Full-time writer.
Yes. Don't worry. Yes. On my way.
I hope I have a chance to read that, and that when it comes out in this country, we'll come back and we'll talk about that.
Well, with pleasure. Thanks very much indeed.